This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Among the things we're all worried about for Tuesday, Election Day, is not just a long night and long days after that where we wait for an outcome. We worry, will the system work? And by that, I don't just mean the election process itself, but the system of, I don't know, democracy, where you fight it out and then leave it to voters. Conceding defeat has to suck, but so far, every loser in a presidential election has done it. And the peaceful transition of power, historians tell us, is really special. It's one of the things in a flawed enterprise that has truly worked so far. But we've had moments where things didn't seem so certain. We've had violence. We've had times where we've kept citizens from casting a vote, where the outcome of the race was disputed and dragged on for months. And it's that history that we're talking about today. Not to give us comfort about Tuesday, but perspective, something to get you ready for anything. So Donald Trump says he's worried about the Democrats stealing the election through voter fraud. Now, let's put aside the fact that he can't substantiate that claim, and let's talk about another Republican who is also worried about Democrats stealing the election, Abraham Lincoln. This wasn't a presidential election. It was his race against Stephen Douglas for the Senate seat in Illinois. But it tells us a lot about the time and about Lincoln's faith in the system. Here's the historian Matthew Pinsker.
When people remember the Lincoln-Douglas race in 1858, they always focus on the debates. But there was an entire campaign bigger than those seven debates. And there was a moment a few days after the final debate where Abraham Lincoln thought he was in danger of getting cheated out of a victory that he expected to come. And he wrote a letter to the Republican Party chairman in Illinois warning him that the Democrats were trying to steal the election. In those days, it was the legislatures that selected the U.S. senators. So Lincoln and Douglas were campaigning in the fall in Illinois to try to affect what we would call swing districts, what they called doubtful districts, where the balance of power might hinge on the election of a representative or a senator. And the key places for that battle was in the western part of the state, the central and western part of Illinois, where most of the doubtful districts were. And in the final weeks of the campaign, Lincoln was campaigning in those doubtful districts, and he thought he uncovered a scheme by the Democrats to try to steal the votes out there.
What's the scheme? What is it that he hears?
He writes this remarkable letter to Norman Judd, who was the Republican Party chairman. And he tells him that while he was traveling through a town called Rushville in western Illinois, he encountered Celtic gentlemen, Irish immigrant workers who were sent apparently to work on railroad lines that were being constructed in western Illinois from Chicago. But Lincoln knew right away that was suspicious because him and all of his peers considered the Democratic Party to be built in large measure on the votes of Irish immigrants in Chicago. And they thought the party was arranging for these immigrant workers to be sent down to doubtful districts so that they could vote on Election Day and cast their ballots illegally in a way that would swing a doubtful district into the Democratic column. Lincoln spells this out in his letter to Norman Judd, and he says in the letter, there's nothing we can do under the current election law to prevent them from swearing falsely and voting illegally. But then he offers what he calls a bare suggestion in the letter, and this is why in some ways it's kind of one of the most remarkable inside political letters in Lincoln's career.
We need to explain bare suggestion, B-A-R-E. What's the idea that he has here? Because it's pretty amazing, I have to say. It seems a little dodgy.
Lincoln's idea of this bare suggestion is to introduce what he calls a man of the detective class among the laborers and to convince them or to trick them not to vote for the Democratic candidate. He says, actually, that the detective should be introduced among them in disguise, and that this is someone who could, at the nick of time, control their votes. Now, we don't know exactly what he meant by control their votes. But he tells Norman Judd, the party chairman, think it over, he says. It would be a great thing when this trick is attempted upon us to have the saddle come up on the other horse. And then he goes on to say that he's talked more fully than he can write to another party leader who will explain the rest of the scheme to Judd when he gets up to Chicago. So for years, Lincoln historians have wondered whether he was outlining some kind of illegal scheme of their own. You could imagine that the detective who would control the votes of these Celtic gentlemen, these Irish railroad workers, was somebody who was going to intimidate them or bribe them. But I actually don't think that's what was going on here. Lincoln is a tough-minded politician. He definitely knew how to play hardball, but he was fundamentally honest. And I think his belief was that they could use some of the misbegotten energy of the Democrats against themselves if they were smart enough and shrewd enough. And so what he wanted the disguised detective to do was to take these immigrant voters and lead them into the wrong district, one that wasn't doubtful, but that was safe, where they could vote for Stephen Douglas's party without having any impact on the race. Now, there's one detail in the letter I haven't described yet, but which is really kind of relevant here, which is Lincoln describes following these Celtic gentlemen into the doggeries of Rushville and other places in western Illinois. The doggeries were the saloons. He's suggesting that these men might be so far removed from home, so far out of their element, and so drunk that a detective in disguise could trick them into wasting their vote rather than casting it illegally. But the question is, was he willing to break the rules in the worst kind of way? Intimidation, suppression, violence, bribery. Some historians have speculated that it's conceivable. I certainly think it's possible, but I don't think it's probable. I think what was really more likely here is that he was taking advantage of the rules of the contest, which made it like an electoral college, and he was taking advantage of some of the unethical aspects of the Democratic operation. He was trying to use it all against them. And to me, that's what this letter reveals. Somebody who played hard, but tried to play within the rules as best he could. Lincoln's bare suggestion went ignored, and they ended up losing almost all of those doubtful districts out there. And Lincoln, therefore, ended up losing the legislative ballot for U.S. Senator. He did not give in to whining, complaining, challenging the contest. Instead, he kept assuring his supporters that they will have victories ahead, that they needed to keep the faith. His underlying faith in the system led him to believe that challenging the legitimacy of the election wasn't worth it, that they should instead fight again another day. It says that he thought about principles bigger than himself.
There's another moment in the story that I think says something about his sense of faith in this democratic process, and it's this memo that he writes. It's a secret memo. Tell us about this.
It's a year after the Union victory at Vicksburg, and people are still dying. And there was a growing fear among Lincoln's advisors that he could not win re-election. And so in the face of that, Lincoln does something remarkable. He sits down and he writes a memo that he intends to show to his potential opponent. He wants to convince this opponent that if he does lose, Lincoln will still transfer power to him peacefully. The memo says, "This morning, as for some days past, it seems exceedingly probable that this administration will not be reelected." And then he says, "It will be my duty to so cooperate with the president-elect as to save the Union between the election and the inauguration, as he will have secured his election on such ground that he cannot possibly save it afterwards." He signed it, and it was the document he intended to open up and show to the Democratic nominee after the Democratic nominee might have won the election, in order to convince this man that from November to March, they should work together to try to end the war, defeat the Confederates once and for all, and find a way to save the Union together if they couldn't do it separately. even in the midst of all of that catastrophe, Lincoln never lost faith in the peaceful transfer of power. And the prospect that there are people today who are wavering in that faith, especially President Trump, I mean, that's what's such a betrayal of the legacy of Lincoln.
Matthew Pinsker, how does history help you think about the present?
History almost always gives me hope because when you look back at the American past, there were all kinds of challenges, setbacks, tragedies, grave mistakes, dark times. And so somehow those people overcame it. Time and again, Americans have risen to the occasion. They figured out a way to overcome a whole series of deep challenges. It's never been perfect, but it's always worked. And that's why even today, when things seem grim, where I get nervous or anxious, I do feel a sense of hope that's rooted in an understanding of our past.
Matthew Pinsker, he's a professor of history at Dickinson College. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Using your smart speaker, starting your day with NPR Utah has never been easier. All you have to do is tell it to play KUER, and we'll be there throughout your morning with news and the latest Utah stories.
Now, the state of Utah has made an important move in this controversial issue. It's the first state in the country to protect.
That's KUER on your smart speaker. Just tell it to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, I guess we're trying to get you ready for Tuesday, for the election, with some stories from the past. We're asking how history can help you think about the present, because whether it offers peace or concern, it always gives you perspective. Joining us on the program is Dr. Stephanie McCurry. She's a professor of American history at Columbia University. And we wanted to talk with her about the presidential election of 1876, because there were a lot of similarities to this election. The country was divided, in a depression. There were questions about the legitimacy of the process, disputes about the outcome, and there wasn't a resolution for months. But we started with Dr. McCurry's personal feelings about the moment, not as an historian necessarily, but an American citizen, just days away from a very important election. She told us she was feeling a sense of dread.
It's a really kind of difficult thing to be a historian living through this moment, actually, because in many ways, your mind does go back to past moments of polarization, divisiveness, electoral violence, and racial conflict. And it's hard. I mean, I feel like I've been thinking way too much about, say, 1876 or 1868. The feeling of dread, I think, comes from the fact that even for me, who's an engaged voter and a knowledgeable citizen, what happened over the last 4 years was really quite unimaginable for me at the beginning. I mean, I wasn't happy about the outcome of the election in 2016. I feel very differently now than I did then. It's very difficult to even remember how shocked we were by certain developments starting in 2016, including just the chaos. I mean, I was thinking last night about the rush on the airports and the Muslim ban, the kind of chaotic implementation of a major policy that affects people, people in the United States, their relatives, family members all over the world. And it goes from there. It's just even hard to remember. It feels like we've been buffeted for 4 years. You know, I think the way the election divided in 2016 with Trump winning the Electoral College but losing the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by almost 3 million votes, it made us, or people like me, kind of focus on the mechanics of the election in ways I think that we never did before. What is the Electoral College? Why is it there? What role does it play? And these are all things that were very much in play in the period after the American Civil War, when we were trying to make a new kind of democracy in the United States. And it was an extremely contentious and even violent, very violent process. So that sense of dread comes down to the fact that the polls can't really reassure, because there's so much that can go wrong and that did go wrong in 2016. If you believe democracy is about what citizens want and who they vote for, and all of a sudden the Electoral College is determinative and possibly could be again.
You say the United States has always been a deeply divided country. And I wondered if you thought that was just, you know, our natural disposition, just our character. I mean, you know, we tell ourselves or have told ourselves over time that that we're united. We've always held that as an ideal. But is it just the nature of the people in this United States that we're inclined to be divided?
We had a civil war.
Yeah.
It started in 1860 with the secession of South Carolina and lasted until 1865, and then was post-litigated by violence and electorally until at least 1877. And the only reason the violence declined, well, it really didn't, but around elections declined, is because there were no more Black voters left. So I don't think it's a matter of human personality or some national characteristic of Americans. This is a country that has a set of democratic ideals embraced by a lot of people, but which had always had a kind of carve out along the lines of race that people are now being asked to confront directly. And many, many people in this country don't like it. They don't like being called to account. There's so many ways in which both the way we, the way our democracy is structured alone, the way our democracy is structured owes so much to the institution of slavery and its aftermath, but including structurally to the institution of slavery in the founding era and right through the First Republic up to 1861. And so I think, you know, a great deal of the divisiveness has to do with that, with the inability to recognize African Americans as full citizens and human beings and fellow Americans, we the people. I can't tell you what it's like to read documents about the American South in the antebellum period, the Civil War, the post-Civil War period, and other parts of the United States where people talk about Americans as if they're white Americans. So I don't think many of your listeners need to be reminded that we're still living with this. And we're still struggling over it. So I don't think it's that there's something about the national character. I think this country was fundamentally divided, literally divided geographically by the institution of slavery. And then there was a civil war. Americans like to forget that there was a civil war. We were not always one country. We were two countries at one point. There's nothing inevitable about the reunification.
So let's talk about that time. This time that you've studied and written about, the time from 1868 to 1876. And let's, of course, focus on that presidential election, 1876. Dr. McCurry, help us understand what's going on in the country in this time. What are the questions, the issues that Americans are confronting? Because you've described this particular time as kind of a national storm.
Yes, I think that's a really good way to put it, right? I mean, most people know that we had this civil war over slavery that lasted from 1861 to 1865. And it began as a political division. Remember, it was about secession. I mean, presumably there was a way that could have been resolved simply as an electoral matter and allow the South to secede, but that's not what happened. And there was a war. So from the total military defeat of the Confederacy in the spring of 1865, the question then was, how do the ex-Confederate South, those 11 states are basically conquered territories. And the question of how to reunify the country, both emotionally, culturally, politically, you know, is a really daunting question. And the political reunification is the most, it's the easiest part to explain, actually. Because there were rules about when the Southern states could rejoin Congress. As you might remember, Lincoln was assassinated, so there was this new president. And between the spring of 1865 and basically 1867, he had a lot of sway, Andrew Johnson, and he was very sympathetic to white Southerners. He wasn't expected to be, but he became very sympathetic. And so he set pretty lenient terms for the readmission of those states to the Union. And under his rules, they would have been allowed to rejoin without changing anything about the voting requirements or the sort of structure of democracy in those states. So African Americans would be free, but they would have very few guaranteed civil rights and no political representation at all. But he was opposed, and because he was such a reactionary, really, he alienated a lot of the moderates of the Republican Party who were in power at that time and who were the allies of African American citizens in that moment, anti-slavery historically, the Free Labor Party. And so at that moment, there were a lot of moderate Republicans who had no intention of awarding the right to vote to Black men. But because Andrew Johnson was so reactionary, he alienated the middle of the Republican Party and kind of created this moment of possibility when radical change was possible. And the radicals in the Republican Party, people like Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania, who genuinely believed that Black men should have, Black people should be free, that they should have full and equal civil rights, and that they, that the men among them should have the right to vote, they managed to get these things through in 1867. And they did it, and they also militarily reoccupied the South. So you couldn't have a more explosive situation short of the war itself. So it's really quite stunning, because here you have people, 4 million people of African descent in the United States who had been enslaved up until 1865 and or 1863 when the Emancipation Proclamation came out, but really with the 13th Amendment in 1865. And within 2 years, they are they have the right to vote. And you've got Black registrars and Black office holders in the South in 1867. This didn't happen in any other society except Haiti, where people of African descent had been enslaved. So it's a pretty radical solution. And the only thing that would have made it possible was both the war, Confederate defeat, and then Andrew Johnson's intransigence. I mean, if Lincoln had been president, there's no way this would have happened this fast.
So it seems like, so this is a really critical moment in 1876, this election, because as you said, there's this question of whether or not the country is going to live up to the rights fought for during the Civil War. And what the what seems like also the one of the questions was, what was the role of the federal government going to be in seeing to it that the South provided those rights? Because I guess it's important to say that the Republicans had federal troops in the rebel states at this time. There was a big federal presence there, and they didn't like it, I guess.
Yeah, no, this is true. I mean, this is a militarily occupied region of the United States. They had waged a war for independence, and they had lost. And they were occupied. They weren't occupied. The troops were withdrawn and then reinstalled in 1867 after the Radical Republicans took control. Yes, the Radical Republicans in Congress have managed to pass this series of amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which essentially attempt to put the federal government to nationalize citizenship. To say, if you're a citizen of the United States, you have all the same rights of any citizen of the United States. And that's quite a radical departure. It's going to get litigated in the courts and gutted, too. So this is all going on simultaneously with court fights. And then the other thing that really inflames the situation is that while the Radical Republicans have a really powerful block in 1867-68, the moderates in the party are not going to vote for every radical thing under every circumstances. And in 1873, there's a market crash, a stock market crash, and there's a big panic, a huge depression, which until the 20th century was called the Depression. And so these moderate Republicans, they get very tired. They come to be called the liberal Republicans or the business Republicans. They get really sick of being this arbiter and protector of Black civil rights in the South, civil and political rights. They want the army out. They want the costs diminished. You know, the United States has never been a fan of a standing army. This is a long, you know, and the army's shrinking the whole time. The violence is getting worse. And in the middle of this, you have this this panic. And so the Republicans aren't that united anymore. They're starting to splinter, which is part of what happens in 1870, explains partly what happens in 1876. And the political will, the national will, even behind the in Republican Party voters to see themselves as playing this role, it's starting to fade.
So this gets us to the election itself. So there's a depression going on. There are all these big questions about the role of the federal government and the role, you know, basically what is going to happen to people who were formerly enslaved? Are they going to have the rights that they were had come to possibly expect? And then we get to the election itself. Rutherford B. Hayes is the Republican candidate. He's the governor of Ohio. General in the Civil War, decorated war hero, I suppose. And then the Democrats had Samuel Tilden. Mm-hmm. He was the governor of New York. Talk a little bit about these particular candidates and whether or not, I mean, I've heard them described as neither of them as terribly inspiring. What can you say about them as figures who might be visionaries for the moment or not?
Well, I think a lot of the focus was on Tilden and on the Democratic Party because they were starting to come back into national political, not dominance, but certainly to contest. You know, the Civil War had really damaged the Democratic Party. They were the party of slavery and the defense of slavery and everything else. Tilden, this guy from New York, is a reform candidate. Who is riding the crest of this wave of disgust at the Grant administration, which has become tarred as a very corrupt administration. So the Democrats can sort of, and Tilden can kind of pose as the anti-corruption party or are the anti-corruption party, certainly in places like New York where they've cleaned out municipal political rings. And so they're looking kind of like the candidates of clean government reform. And the Grant administration, which has had two terms, not only has done all these things that we might now think of as admirable, right, like pass these amendments, but it's also the government of military occupation and of a two-term administration with a lot of patronage to give out and all these charges of corruption that are sticking to it. So the tide is running against the Republicans, but the tide is also running against the Republicans because of what has happened in the South. The Democrats are still the party of white supremacy. They're also the party so-called of progressive reform. Those things often go together. You can't separate the fortunes of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party from this more on-the-ground, pretty brutal bloodbath of a political battle that's being fought out inside Southern states. So that's kind of the setting in 1876 when the election comes.
So let's talk about the election itself. It's basically, as I understand it, Hayes, the Republican, Rutherford B. Hayes, goes to bed thinking that he had lost that night, that Tilden was ahead in the popular vote. Some newspapers even said Tilden had won. But it gets more complicated than that. Explain what happens on election day and the days after.
Right. So this is, you know, kind of a reminder that you can only presidential election can only be projected on election day, not actually announced. So as I understand it, what happened here is that the election results were so close that no winner could be announced immediately. And I think you're right that the early election results seem to indicate a Democratic victory. The Democrats take most of the South for reasons I explained, and New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Indiana, and the Republicans take most of the North. And it seems pretty clear, even on election day, that Tilden has a pretty big lead in the popular vote. And that seems to indicate that he's the winner. And that, I think, was thought to be the case at some various points that day. But the Republicans are insisting that Hayes would have won if not for Democratic violence and voter suppression in the Southern states. And the Electoral College votes have not all been returned. And the ones that are coming out of the South involve some contested elections, which had been very common in Reconstruction. Reconstruction had more contested elections and more investigations into contested elections than any other period in American history. So the popular vote looks clearly for the Democrat, for Tilden, but the Electoral College votes kind of get stalled in their reporting. So I think it was something like Tilden is ahead, but there's no total amount of votes. So Tilden seems to have a secure 184 votes. You need 185 to win. So he's really close.
Yeah.
And Hayes has 165 electoral college votes, but the votes of four, the electoral college votes for four different states have not been returned. And three of them are in the South, and three of them are those places where the Republicans are still in power, still control the machinery of the elections, where the electoral college votes would add up to enough to put Hayes up one. There's one that involves Oregon, and I can't really explain what happened with Oregon, but there's 20 contested electoral votes, 20 unassigned, I should say. And Florida has four, South Carolina has seven, Louisiana has eight. And the question is, who are those votes going to go to? And that question remains unresolved from Election Day until March 2nd.
Wow. It's finally decided. And maybe we should mention, they hand this over to Congress. And this Electoral Commission, it made up of eight Republicans, as I understand it, and seven Democrats. That's critical there. They decide whose candidate is going to win. And of course, I guess they vote along party lines.
Yes, but it doesn't appear to be that simple. And some of this might be relevant to us as we worry our way through the next week and hopefully not next 4 months.
Right. So
apparently, I just checked this. Apparently, the Constitution is very vague on how to resolve any kind of issue about the Electoral College. And so in 2000, it went to the Supreme Court.
Right.
But there's nothing obvious about that. As you just mentioned, in 1876, it went to this Electoral Commission, which Congress actually voted a bill to make that happen. So there was a prior political bargaining and negotiation to even settle on the process by which this was going to be resolved. And then they don't vote that through until the end of January. And then this 15-member thing has five members of the House, five members of the Senate, and five Supreme Court justices. And so it's actually the Supreme Court justices that make the partisan alignment favorable to the Republicans.
Wow.
Because in the 19th century, the Supreme Court was recognized far more directly as a political institution than it is now, a partisan institution. In fact, I think we're on our way very well along our way back to that. And so three of the Supreme Court justices are Republicans and two are Democrats, and they're understood to be that. I mean, just in the way ours are now.
Except
there was no barrier to overcome of thinking, well, they have to claim to be neutral. So this is a complicated process in and of itself. And I think it's really interesting to think about the fact that, you know, there's different models of how to resolve electoral college standoffs or contested election standoffs. So the negotiations over this are extremely complicated. It's called, you know, C. Van Woodward, this famous historian, called it the Compromise of 1877. But it's some kind of a political deal. And I don't think it's as simple as, you know, once the commission was set up, the one Republican additional vote meant that they were going to win. The political history that people have written of this suggests an enormous amount of bargaining, deal-making, backdooring. And the deal that seems to have been involved, people do say that Tilden was not as much a hardball player and his team was not as much a hardball player as Hayes, which is interesting. That always matters, right? The really important part of the bargain appears to be that if the Republicans get the Electoral College votes, and remember, they have to pretty much give them all to him. If he gets them and he wins the presidency, the deal appears to be that the Democrats, what they're given is control over their own states again, that the federal government will remove the troops and stop meddling in Southern politics, stop being the guarantor of African-American political and civil rights in the South. In other words, home rule for those Southern states, and all of those states, but especially South Carolina, their own elections were contested. Their governor's election was contested. It had been a bloodbath in South Carolina in 1876. And so everybody there knew, in a way, Black Republicans in those Southern states were sacrificed by the National Republican Party to get that deal for Hayes. And shortly after the votes were given to him and he was inaugurated on the 4th of March, which was when people were inaugurated in the 19th century, they did withdrew the remaining troops from the South. And the Republican governor of South Carolina, who claimed to have won the election, even with the violence and the black voter suppression, he had to leave office because the red shirts, the violent white supremacist forces in South Carolina, took over the state house and they installed their own candidate for governor, Wade Hampton. So the national picture, which sounds quite clinical, is actually not both the result of and then delivers this Democratic victory in the South, in these states, that ends Reconstruction. Yeah. And pretty much seals the deal for black voters into the 20th century.
So the Republicans get the White House, but the Democrats get control of the South again. And all of the, most of anyway, I guess slavery was still outlawed. But in effect, a lot of the things that had been fought for during the Civil War were completely undermined by that compromise.
Black people no longer had the political clout to enforce any of that. And the courts had always been a problem, including the Supreme Court, but not only the Supreme Court. They had been really eviscerating or chipping away at the meaning of these amendments from the minute that they were passed. So the legal battle had been ongoing, and now the political battle had been ongoing, and the political battle was basically lost.
Yeah. I saw this quote recently from W.E.B. Du Bois that went like this. The slave went free, stood a brief moment in the sun, then moved back again toward slavery. Like there was a moment when it seemed like the slave, the former slave, was going to emerge as a, you know, as this figure who had actual rights in this country. And then this moment happens. And as he says, they go back toward that feeling of being enslaved again, I guess.
I mean, it's a really, you know, Du Bois is so powerful on this point, partly because he spends a lot of time describing the kind of governments and public policies that Republicans adopted in these southern states when they were in power and when they were serving the black community as well as the white. And it's really admirable. I mean, it's a much more inclusive vision of democracy and the work of government, you know, redistributive tax policies, the abolition of the death penalty for certain crimes, the rewriting of the criminal code, the installation of public funded education for all children, black or white, all these very, you know, important basic things that are about human dignity and human equality. And, you know, Du Bois says, as you just quoted, you know, we had these 7 years in the sun. And of course, this is what Ta-Nehisi Coates is talking about when we were 8 years in power, you know, about the Obama administration, which I don't think was anywhere near as radical. So, you know, I think it's not slavery. The Confederates lost. And I think it is worth remembering that they tried to make slavery last into the indefinite future. And they failed in that. And that is a major accomplishment. And whatever these white supremacists do, they really cannot reinstall that regime of slavery. In part, that's what their fury and rage is about, that the subservience of African Americans will never be as total as it was then. And they're always working their way to eliminate those freedoms and those gains, and including this sort of, you know, just human dignity that comes from emancipation and from how African Americans define their status and their family lives and community lives after slavery. So, you know, Reconstruction is both the reason people keep talking about the first, you know, that we need another Reconstruction. We're in the third. The Civil Rights Movement was the second Reconstruction. We need a third Reconstruction. It's not because it failed, right? It's because it did these things. It's because of what was possible then. So this is one of the reasons I think that Reconstruction remains this incredibly gripping chapter of American history, is that it's both those things. I mean, I don't think of it as a failure, because I think we, to say that is to underestimate the challenge of making any society a dignified, equal one. part of the thing about Reconstruction is it's so inspiring. And Du Bois captures that better than anybody, and then it's lost.
Yeah. How close, Doctor, did we get to actual violence in the streets during that time? I know there was a lot of talk when things were up in the air about who was actually going to be declared president. Democrats had talked about getting into the streets. There were rumors about these militias that would get involved. A lot of, I have to say, relevance to the moment now when you're hearing about this kind of thing, you know, whether or not there will be militias in place observing elections on Tuesday. The Republicans in 1876 also apparently were preparing for some kind of war. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, I think one of the things that our listeners need to know is that within the Southern states since 1867, elections had been conducted in a paramilitary context. And in fact, it had been true during the secession crisis as well. So this was a part of the country. Let me just say, elections were quite violent in the 19th century period. I mean, people went armed to the polls. It was part of the argument about why women shouldn't vote, is that they shouldn't be there, that it was too dangerous, it was too violent. A lot of drunk people, a lot of guns. I mean, you know, it was always the case, a very raucous gun culture around the polls. Since 1867, when Black people had the right to vote, Black men had the right to vote in the Southern states, first the Klan and then other groups, they called themselves rifle clubs, red shirts, they had always arrived armed at the polls, armed and mounted. And for Black people to carry arms in the South was, you know, a death sentence. So, and in fact, the context leading up to 1876, there had been a massacre in Hamburg, South Carolina, in the summer of 1876 during electioneering, where numbers of people were gunned down, Black men were gunned down in the streets of Hamburg by these 1,000 red shirts. That's these sort of white paramilitary, white supremacist groups from Georgia and South Carolina rode into town and gunned these people down. And in fact, the context was so violent that Grant, who was still president, outlawed rifle clubs in South Carolina and established some soldiers at the polls to protect the polls. But I mean, not enough to do very much, but I mean, yeah. Imagine if we did that now. So, yeah, it was an incredibly violent moment. But in that sense, it wasn't all post-election. It was the nature of the political contest and political culture and political life in the Reconstruction South.
You have said that the effort to suppress the Black vote in these elections during that time haunt you. That's what you've written. And so does the fact you say that they won. Explain why. Why does it haunt you? Is it that you see those conditions in place today?
The conditions haunt me because the tolerance for violence in the United States and public violence is greater than I think any democratic society really should have to tolerate. The gun laws, the fact that people can have guns at the polls, that there can be. I can't get over the image of the Michigan State House, for example. This feels like the 19th century when armed white militias arrive, you know, burly men armed to the teeth. How is this allowed? And do we not think that violence, that we're on the verge of violence when people choose to represent themselves politically in that way? I mean, the slogan in South Carolina was, you can't vote if you're dead.
Yeah.
So, of course, this haunts me. And the fact that they won in the 19th century and in Reconstruction, that violence works. This one thing relevant is, you know, it's a detail, but I grew up in Northern Ireland. I grew up in Belfast. I don't have an implicit trust that democracies work by nonviolent means. I know for a fact that they don't. Violence is not always just a threatening part on the edge to threaten people. It is sometimes how elections are decided. Bodies are fragile. You can intimidate people. You can hurt and maim people. You can scare people away from the polls. I'm not saying that we're there right now, but I'm saying that it's unfortunate I know so much about 1876. And in a United States where the public tolerance, where the right to be armed is defended and lauded as one of the key rights of a citizen in a democracy, I think that's a real tension in a polarized political culture.
So, Doctor, how does history help you think about then, I guess, the present? And does it give you, I mean, from what you've just said, I was going to ask, does it give you comfort or does it worry you? Because it sounds like in some ways, as you reflect back in your knowledge of the history of the past, there would be a reason to be worried. How do you think about history? How do you use history in a practical way to give you perspective of the moment, I guess?
Well, I think what it does is give you perspective, and it opens your mind to possibilities. It makes you catalog the possibilities maybe in a different way than a person who's not a historian. I can't help but think about the past. It doesn't give you, in the way people often think, you know, when they say history will judge you. Well, history is always a divided, and historians and the way people write history is always a contested and divided matter. The judgment is never rendered in any clear and uncontested way. Just like the present is a contested present. But the perspective that it gives me in this particular moment is real worry. We acknowledge it at times, but the struggle over racial equality in this country goes so deep, and people's commitment to racial privilege and to masculine privilege also, I think, which was a big element of 2016, it goes so deep in people's psyche that they act on it without even, some are very clear about what they're doing, but there are hopeful signs, you know, and I think I, in this particular moment, a few days before the election, I literally seesaw between hope and fear.
Okay, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but finally, what kind of guidance do you give people listening right now about how to see this moment in time and how to prepare themselves for Tuesday, for Election Day?
Well, what a great question. I really don't know. I mean, I think the thing that worries me the most is how much can go wrong.
Yeah.
And so in terms of preparing, I already voted. I voted early. I voted in person. I think we have to pay more attention than we should to the mechanics of voting, where we live, what's allowed, how's it counted, how long do you have. Whoever you're voting for, you have to do it with very, very mindful of the mechanics and the laws and the rules. And that's, I think it's a tax on people to have to pay that much attention. I mean, in Canada, when you're registered with the census, you're registered to vote. I mean, all these mechanisms in the United States have a lot to do with keeping Black people from voting. We have huge voter turnout, it looks like, which is a great sign, I think. I think just paying attention to the mechanics and trying to, I don't know what's going to happen. I think insisting that everybody stay calm until the outcome of the vote is known, which could take some time. I think people should be not carrying weapons in public. I think if everybody committed to that, I'd be a lot less worried, and wait for the outcome and hope for the best.
Dr. Stephanie McCurry, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That's Stephanie McCurry. She's a professor of American history at Columbia University. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Ivana Martinez. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.